cultural institutions, our libraries, archives, galleries and museums are centres of knowledge. They hold a key to our past. Yet over the centuries, many cultural centres have been destroyed by both man and nature. Out of the Ashes is a new lecture series taking place at Trinity College Dublin, exploring cultural loss and recovery over the centuries, from the Library of Alexandria, which was lost in antiquity, to the destruction of the Public Record Office in Ireland at the outset of the Irish Civil War in 1922. Joining me in studio are Dr. Peter Crooks, historian at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Ismail Seligeldin, founding director of the new Library of Alexandria. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Dr. Seligeldin, the famous Library of Alexandria, when and why was it established?
Well, it was in the wake of the enormous conquests of Alexander the Great, who people should know was also tutored by Aristotle. So, I mean, can you imagine having Aristotle as your personal tutor? But anyway, so he went to conquer the world, but he also wanted to combine the cultures of the world. And he selected the site of Alexandria, but he never came back alive. So it was Ptolemy the First who actually built the city and then built what was a strange institution. It was called a temple to the muses to bring the greatest minds of the world to Alexandria. So it was part academy, part research institute, part teaching facility. And they had the botanical garden, zoological garden, a dissection room, and the library. Mm. And the library grew and grew and grew until the name of the library has several buildings, and the name of the library dominated the whole complex. And it was unique in the sense that there were Greek libraries and Egyptian libraries before, but this was the first time that there was a library devoted to universal knowledge.
So a global library, basically.
Global library. The first global library.
And are there drawings that survive? Do we have any images? Do we have an idea of what it might have looked like?
Regretfully, we don't. We have only descriptions that are fairly vague, that there were columns and lintels and squares in which scrolls were found. But that's too vague a description. It could fit many things. We have very precise descriptions of the lighthouse of Alexandria, the other marvel of that time. But the library is, the descriptions are too vague to have an accurate reconstruction. So people imagine it.
Yeah, and when people think of libraries, they think of stacks, they think of books. But this was mostly scrolls, wasn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. We moved from scrolls to codex, which is the form of the book we have, between 200 and 500 AD. Now, the library was formed at the 288, so almost 300 BC. So it's over 500 years later that we started getting codexes.
And what happened to it?
What happened to it was initially, it was an enormous success that attracted everybody who was anybody. We had like visiting professors. Archimedes came and spent 2.5 years. Euclid, the great Euclid, was a full-time employee of the ancient library. He wrote Euclidean geometry that you and I learned at school while being there. Can you imagine if we could have the royalties till now?
Oh, yeah.
Euclidean geometry. And all of these guys were there. Then, until you reach Cleopatra. And Cleopatra, the time that Julius Caesar arrives, that time Rome is on the ascendant, Egypt is going down, and she was kicked out by her brother, but she convinces Caesar to stand by her. And there's a war, the Alexandrian War of Julius Caesar. And one of the buildings of the library is burnt. That's the first big fire, 48 BC. And depending on who you read, 40,000, 400,000, 100,000 scrolls were burnt, we don't know. But we do know that to make peace with Cleopatra and to get into her good graces, her second great lover, Antony, gave her the 200,000 scrolls of Pergamon. And that says something about Cleopatra, that the way to her heart was a massive book donation to the library to make up for the loss of the first fire. The second big fire was when another remarkable woman, Zenobia of Palmyra, actually conquers Egypt but is looked upon as a savior because the Romans were persecuting the Christians in a terrible way. So the Christians in Alexandria at the time welcome her. But Aurelian, Emperor Aurelian, retakes everything. And there he burns down the entire royal quarter. not only including the original museon or museum of the library, but also the palaces, the temples, and the tomb of Alexander the Great. All of that was destroyed. So that was 272 AD. And then what the remnants of the library go into the temple to Serapis. It's called the Daughter Library. And that it gets destroyed in 391 when the Emperor Theodosius forbids other religions than Christianity for the Roman Empire. And therefore the pagan temples are destroyed. And Serapis being a pagan god, that temple gets destroyed.
So is there anything left? Does anything survive of the original library?
No.
Right. So
nothing survives except, of course, there were some manuscripts that went around. And it was, believe it or not, a Muslim, half Arab, half Persian, Khalif, who you have to think of Baghdad of the Arabian Nights. So he decides to force translation of all science into Arabic. And he pays anybody who will translate an old manuscript the weight in gold of the manuscript, yes. And his minister of finance...
Sorry, for a moment I thought you were going to say their weight in gold, just the weight of the manuscript.
Just
the
manuscript. So his grand vizier tells him, sire, the scientists are cheating. They're writing in big letters on thick paper. And he says to them, let them be, for what they give us is so much more valuable than the gold we give them. But what's important about that is that anybody who had a manuscript, and this is the Abbasid Empire spending from Morocco to India, from Central Asia to Africa, and they would bring it to Baghdad and then have it translated. And we recapture some of the lost manuscripts through this big translation effort in the 9th century. That gets copied and recopied, and that becomes part of the huge legacy that the Renaissance would rediscover later on.
So you are appointed the founding director of the new Library of Alexandria. Now, given what you've just described, that is a monumental task. So what kind of challenges were you faced with in trying to establish the new Library of Alexandria?
Well, I was called in. They had already had a competition to have a beautiful building, very beautiful building. It won many, many awards. But the question was, what's going to happen in this building? So I had a discussion then with the First Lady of Egypt, Mrs. Mubarak, who was the patron of that project. And I said to her, we have to recapture the spirit of the ancient library, but with the tools of the new century. So this was 2000, 2001 at the time. IT, the internet, etc. was coming alive. And yes, it was a monumental task. I started with zero employees. I left it with 2,400, with 15 research institutes, 19 museums and art galleries, a planetarium, exploratorium, a huge conference center, a tremendous outreach program, and many specialized libraries. And when people told me, but you will never be able to buy all the books in the world like they did in the ancient library, I said, no, but I do have the only copy of the Internet Archive outside of San Francisco. Mm. And in the new century, this will be where the common memory of humanity will be found.
And, you know, how much of the new library is actual, how much of it is virtual?
More virtual. We are actually, we've received major gifts. I was able to convince people. France gave me 500,000 volumes, which makes us the fourth largest Francophone library outside of France. I got from the Netherlands 420,000 books. So we have about 2.something million physical books. Mm. But of course, the major new direction is everything is information.
Everything is virtual. It's an extraordinary story. Peter, we experienced loss of our cultural heritage, most famously the destruction of the Public Record Office in the forecourts at the start of the Irish Civil War. And I mean, your project basically is going about rectifying that in a virtual sense.
Yeah, I mean, at a national level, it is the national archival tragedy for Ireland. But it's not just an Irish story, given how far Ireland has spread its culture and how close the connections are between this island and the neighbours. So it is the Irish National Archival loss, but it is a very significant archive, and it's very exciting that we can say now that we're moving ahead to the centenary of that in 2022 with the expectation, with the hope that we will have created a virtual archive. There's going to be more to be done by the time we get to 2022, but we're creating a framework that will, I think, transform the way we engage with our past.
And were there attempts in the past to recover some of those records?
Immediately afterwards, two things happen. One is there's a huge shock to the archivists who are in the building, and some of them seek transfers elsewhere and retire. But very rapidly, for instance, the Irish Manuscripts Commission is founded in 1928, and it is engaging in extensive archival exploration and publication endeavours. There are strong connections built between the new Public Record Office Belfast, which is founded in 1923, 1 year after the fire, and they're engaging in archival discovery in an effort to remedy the losses of the fire. And in our project, what's exciting is that these different partners, north, south, east, west, are coming together to work now on a virtual archive. You talked about the distinction between the virtual and the real, but in a sense, I think what Ismail is saying is that in this century, the virtual is partly the real.
And also, I mean, there's a global element to this as well, because you're turning up material which relates to the material that was kept in the Public Record Office. You're turning it up from all over the world.
Yeah, that's incredibly exciting. And I think we can find that the more that news of this project gets out there, the more we're going to discover. The significant findings in the Huntington Library in California, in Philadelphia, in Canada, all over the UK, in continental archives and so on. It's that documentary diaspora is what we're trying to bring back together. Partly it's to do with how sales of people's manuscripts are dispersed, and just through luck they can happen up, silt up anywhere. Partly it's to do with historical connections between the two islands and the silting up of records in the UK in particular, because of the colonial connection there. Mm.
Dr. Sarah Geldon, anybody listening to you will realise when you're mentioning people like Mrs. Mubarak, for example, that politics in Egypt has moved on quite a lot since this project began in 2002. During the Arab Spring, for example, was there a fear that the library might be attacked or damaged in some way?
Indeed, and this was one of the most exalting moments in my life. As you know from your memories of the revolution in Egypt, it was an enormous people's movement, millions and millions of people in the streets. But they actually also burnt the government house in Alexandria, the party headquarters. But when they came to the library, the young revolutionaries held hands and created human chains and said, "This is the library, nobody touches it." Mm-hmm. We were protected by the revolutionaries, even though the library was a prime project of the Mubarak era. But they recognized that the work we were doing, the young people protected us, so we didn't need any protection, and we were never targeted as a building. And so although there is no walls around the library, and the doors are made of glass.
Other institutions, though, academic institutions, archival institutions in Egypt weren't quite so lucky. The Academy of Science in Cairo, for example, was burned
down to the ground,
Peter, tell us a little bit about, when we hear Dr. Sarah Geldon talking about that, immediately you start thinking of Baghdad, you start thinking of Palmyra, for example. Just talk to us about some of the destruction of amazing archives and amazing artifacts that has taken place over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, what we're trying to do in the series is to locate our own Irish experience in that international context. The interest for me was in 1995, I think it was, UNESCO published this report that's called Lost Memory. And it lists, it's not a very happy document, it lists all the archives and libraries. It doesn't even get into museums and other physical heritage, but libraries and archives destroyed in 20th century armed conflict. Long list, very comprehensive, alphabetically organized, Iceland, Hungary, and so on. Ireland didn't submit to it. I don't know why, but Ireland didn't locate itself in that context. So the purpose of this series, Out of the Ashes, is to connect what we've experienced as an island with this international context. As you say, it goes right up to the contemporary moment. It's not just armed conflict. It can also be accidental fire. Within the last year, we've had Brazil, for instance, the National Museum, the Glasgow School of Art for the second time. So it doesn't, in one sense, it does matter how the thing happens, but how one copes with cultural trauma trauma and cultural loss is something that many of our neighbours and internationally we're seeing. And across the 3 years, we're trying to explore that in as complex a way as we can by moving through the stages. So the first year, and really our emphasis here is on collections, the idea that a collection is an expression of identity, a collection of knowledge and so on. In the second year, we move on to what happens when those are destroyed. And so you mentioned Baghdad, Sarajevo, and Palmyra, some of these are very well-known examples, but the history behind them is very complex. And then in the third year, as we're moving towards 2022 on our own centenary, we'll be talking about recovery. The 2022 project will be part of that, but also other examples of how people have responded creatively, emotionally, dealing with that experience of loss.
So this is all part of the Out of the Ashes lecture series, which is taking place over a period of time in Trinity College.
That's right. It's a three-year series, about 15 lectures across 3 years. We have 5 lectures across the current year.
But Dr. Sarah Gallagher, I presume you can't actually rest on your laurels, because you're talking about a virtual archive. You're talking about technology which quickly can become outmoded. So there's no absolute guarantee that if you collect data 5 years ago, that it's going to be accessible 5 years from now. So you've got to keep on working at it, don't you?
Yes, we do. Actually, we are. I still use the Wii because I've now retired last year from the library, passed on to a new director of the library. But the library has been involved with the IIPC, which is the International Internet Preservation Consortium, about 150 institutions, including Library of Congress, Internet Archives, and so on. And we are worrying about the speed with which information is growing, and the big data analytics and so on, but just the enormous amount of records on the internet. Just to give you an idea, the entire legacy of humanity in 2007 was estimated at 256 exabytes. And we are now putting 2 exabytes a day on the internet. Now, just to give you an idea, what's an exabyte? Well, if you were to digitize all the text in the Library of Congress, all the text, 1 exabyte would be 100,000 times bigger.
Oh, my God. That's phenomenal.
So, phenomenal.
But and we're putting two of those
every
day.
A day on the internet.
Oh, my God.
Now, the question is, what's going to happen to this information? Okay, we're coping with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of it is ephemeral, but ephemeral
it's
is kept, interesting.
Hardly, you know, that's part of the problem with many politicians and with many of the social media problems right now. If somebody writes something nasty about you on the internet, you have no guarantee that it will ever be erased. Hmm. Somebody will be able to find it somewhere. But the question is, how do we cope with a totally new problem, which we've never had before? I mean, people were trying to build collections. People were trying to buy books. Another question is, okay, you can actually get far more than you can handle. And the question becomes, that's why Google is so rich, because they have a system for searching information and so on. We also don't know, we know approximately that the longevity of it is nowhere near like books. Books, especially pre-1850 when they were not using acidic paper, can live almost forever. You open the book, you can start reading without any programs to boot up and so on. Mm. But we are afraid of having an ocean of zeros and ones and then not being able to read them because the programs for which they were written to be read from have themselves become obsolete and we have difficulty finding it. So, but there's a number of very distinguished people from all over the world that are thinking about these problems. How do we preserve and maintain this? We've had two problems. One is physical obsolescence, which means that the magnetic stuff can disintegrate. The other one is technical obsolescence. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember the black diskettes.
Indeed. We used.
Well, you can't
floppy
play them
discs?
Anywhere. Yeah, so floppy. Forget about floppy, just the hard ones. You can't play them anywhere now. Mm. I mean, you just don't have them. Mm. Right now, even the CDs are disappearing. MP3 on one side and flash sticks on the other. Flash sticks will disappear. So the technical obsolescence has been much faster than the physical obsolescence, but it poses different kinds of problems. We are involved with groups in trying to think, as the Library of Alexandria, how we should be custodians of this growing amount of data. And the problem is that you can't select. I mean, the effort of trying to select between 200,000 times all the text of the Library of Congress every day, Who's going to select that? So technically you say, well, let's save everything.
Well, there's also the issue, should you select? Because how do you know what's going to be of interest to scholars of the future? I mean, I use the word ephemera, but I mean, we even have in our own National Library, we have a department of ephemera. So that kind of material, which would have been seen as unimportant and whimsical 100 years ago, is fascinating now.
Yeah, but the problem is that right now, the only answer is save everything. So we are looking for technological answers to save everything and then for partly software and other types of answers to be able to search in it and find what you want. So suddenly, as I said, the problems have become the inverse, where you used to want money to buy books and increase your collections. And now you're trying to say, you know, how do I cope with this tsunami of information that is coming out, the vast majority of which is nonsense and not interesting, but who can sort it out.
Exactly. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us, both of you, Dr. Ismail Sarah-Geldon and Dr. Peter Crooks. Thank you for joining us this evening. We'll put details of the Out of the Ashes lecture series on our website, rte.ie/history.